Okay, so I would like to invite the first panel of the day up, moderated by my colleague James Lee. Thank you, everyone, for coming this morning. I'd like to kick it off. This is sort of a continuation of what we did yesterday when Mike Rice, my colleague, talked about intractable hemalignancies. We're going to be talking a little bit more about the solid tumors today. So just to begin, I want to give a chance for my panelists to introduce themselves, and I think Denise has a few slides also she might want to present.
Sure.
You want to begin?
That sounds fine. Good morning. I'm Denise Ranke. I'm the president and CEO of SARC, Sarcoma Alliance for Research Through Collaboration. And it is a nonprofit research consortium that was established by physician scientists who are interested in making progress in sarcoma. And the couple slides that I have, I just thought we'd start out with just kind of bringing us all to the same page. I think mostly when we think of cancer, we think of carcinoma and the more common types of cancer. Whereas sarcomas, which are diseases of the bony skeleton and the connective tissues, accounts for 1% of all adult cancers and 15% of pediatric cancers. So when we look at the cancer facts and figures for 2018, we really are looking at an uncommon disease that oftentimes, when metastatic, is intractable. So with the next slide, just putting it in context of where it sits in terms of a more common cancers, carcinomas, you can see that we really are dealing with a much more uncommon area, which is really going to be our topic today to really look at, why explore these areas, what's important, what can we learn from them. And then the last slide just briefly goes into looking at overall survival in the two major categories of sarcomas, soft tissue and bone, and you can see there really is opportunity to make progress in this area. So hence this group of physician scientists recognizing that they really needed to pool their intellect as well as patient population to make progress in the area of sarcoma. They formed this consortium, and we're now 15 years old, and we've done a variety of different studies from phase one, phase two, primarily investigator-initiated, but we've also partnered with biotech and pharma for registration studies, really bringing together the community of researchers, preclinical as well as clinical researchers, to understand these diseases better and make more informed decisions about how we design clinical trials to ultimately make progress for these patients.
Thank you. Wendy?
Good morning, everybody. I'm Wendy Selig, and I'm actually an independent consultant now. I have a firm called WS Collaborative. And my background is I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, but I have worked in patient advocacy for cancer for most of my career, and previously was the CEO of the Melanoma Research Alliance. I now work with a number of intractable cancer patient advocacy groups, working directly in figuring out how to change the research paradigm, so for pancreatic cancer, for brain tumors, and other cancers, lung cancer, and some of the more specific subtypes that are still very much intractable. So I think that's why I'm here. I want to spend my time today. I think I had panel envy for the panel yesterday with the patient advocates, not the least of which because TJ Sharp is one of the most amazing advocates that I came to know when I was at the Melanoma Research Alliance. But I think my message today is going to be about how the various stakeholders that are represented in the room today and frankly represented on this panel can come together to turn an intractable cancer into a very different story going forward. So thank you.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Tricoli, and I'm the CEO of Nanobiotics in the U.S. It's not the panelist you were expecting in this panel, because actually I'm replacing my colleague Michael, which is the head of the U.S. development. Sorry he couldn't make it because he had personal issue this morning, and he would have been probably much more valuable than myself here because he's certainly more knowledgeable in this field. And I regret that, but I regret also that we didn't get a chance to have a radio-oncologist on the panel, which is, however, representing a large part of cancer treatment and cancer progress also. So now at Nanobiotics, what do we do? Actually, we're developing different platform leveraging physics and nanoparticles, obviously one in oncology, which is the most advanced, and we are currently having seven clinical trials running, three in Europe, two in Asia Pacific with a partnership, and two in the US now. And we're treating 10 subtypes of population, including sarcoma. And we're going to talk maybe a bit about that one. Already we've been treating more than 200 patients in 60 different centers worldwide now. This product is a quite straightforward single injection intratumoral. Actually, activated by radiation, and is acting as a radio enhancer, radio expander, triggering both the cellular destruction and also the adaptive immune response. I'm going to stop here for now.
Thank you. Lastly, Dr. Tuvison.
Good morning, everybody. I'm the Cancer Center Director at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, about 30 miles from here on the North Shore. And I'm the chief scientist for the Lustgarten Foundation, which is the largest private funder of pancreas cancer research in this country and worldwide. So in many ways, what I spend my time on reflects the title of this session, which are Advances in Intractable Cancers. I'd say reflecting on some of the comments of the other panelists today, pancreas cancer is a poster child, I guess, of this topic. And that, like glioblastoma, it has pretty much the same outcomes, not due to lack of interest from the corporate side or the academic side, but just due to a lack of the ability of our ideas to have an impact on the patients. We've had one big hit so far in pancreas cancer, which is the finding that 2% of patients have mismatch repair abnormalities. They are MSI high, something the moderator this morning summarized one of the slides yesterday. These patients have a Lazarus effect when they're treated with immune checkpoint blockade with Merck's Pembro. It's now approved to treat pancreas cancer patients that have MSI. So that's 2%. So we have 98% of the patients left. And like Wendy and Denise was talking about sarcomas and its dozens of types of cancer. Few patients in each bin. In the common cancers are made up of dozens of patients that have unique characteristics. So the concept of rare cancers exists in our common cancers. And if we could actually pay attention to each patient, we could help groups of them within our common cancer areas, including our intractable cancer. So really the logic that is being used to go after sarcoma, glioblastoma, lung cancer, can be applied to pancreas cancer too, and I hope we have a spirited hour session to discuss that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your introductions. So I'll just give an introduction of our panel and why is it really important. I think it's kind of been discussed, like what are the major issues with these type of intractable diseases. So yesterday we did talk, as I mentioned, we talked about the intractable heme malignancies, and also we touched a little bit about these innovative trials and collaborations with nonprofits. Well, here we're going to dive a little deeper into that because, you know, the stakeholders specifically for these solid tumors, the intractable solid tumors, revolve a lot around the panelists you see here. And I thought, you know, gathering everyone together would generate a good dialogue and hopefully generate some more interest in the industry to, you know, pursue these intractable diseases. And obviously, we all understand that there's a reluctancy to go into these intractable cancers. I mean, there's, you know, if you had an option to do a proof of concept study in melanoma or non-small cell lung cancer, where potentially you can generate a larger, you know, value for your drug in the long run, why would you choose to go after, you know, sarcoma or pancreatic cancer, where typically people in the industry think of these as the graveyards of your cancer drugs? So, you know, there's a reluctancy, and we can talk about, you know, what's going on here and why maybe you should think twice before, you know, dismissing it. And also, maybe, you know, recently FDA and novel innovative trial designs have also helped hopefully to make it more of a de-risk proposition to go into these intractable diseases. So hopefully we can talk a little bit about those type of novel designs that are being implemented now in the clinic. And lastly, to, you know, really try to kick this off and, you know, shed some, you know, positive light to this idea of advances in intractable cancers, we can look back, you know, not too long ago, melanoma itself was one of those intractable cancers. And I want, you know, Wendy maybe can kick it off and talk about her experience of how, you know, when she was at the Melanoma Research Alliance and how that has, you know, changed significantly, as everyone knows, from an intractable disease to one of the more tractable ones.
Wendy? Great. Thank you so much. So when we had our pre-call, some of us on the phone, you know, I was sort of reflecting on how the world changes. And I think in the introduction, we also heard, you know, 5 years ago, the conversation about immunotherapy in this room was quite different. And the same, I think, can be said for melanoma, although two quick disclaimers. One is I no longer represent the Melanoma Research Alliance, so my reflections and my comments are my own based on my experience while I was there. And again, I'll say again that I'm not a scientist or a physician, and I don't even play one on TV. And the third thing I guess I would say as a disclaimer is that in no way is melanoma solved. So I think it's really important to understand that while the landscape has changed for metastatic melanoma patients, and we saw TJ yesterday, such an amazing example of how that world has changed, there are still patients dying of melanoma. And there are subtypes of melanoma that are not responding in the same way that others do. So to what Dr. Tuvason said, again, getting down to those rare subtypes is still very important. And I would say my experience at melanoma, so when I arrived there, it was the end of 2009, and, you know, it was considered in some ways a graveyard. It hadn't been long since the tremelimumab failure had occurred. And what's interesting now in hindsight, after IPI was approved, CTLA-4, is how important the trial design is, how important the understanding of the mechanism of the drug is, and the population. You can quickly turn the wrong corner and, you know, relegate a potentially promising compound to the dustbin if you don't really understand what's going on. And I think that the scientists and the physicians who worked on IPI were pretty brave to, you know, not sort of take that signal and run for the hills. We might have had a very different story if that had happened. But things were not so good for a metastatic melanoma patients at the time I got to the MRA. And there was, I think, a little bit of a perfect storm that happened at that time, which is kind of my message today. So the science, obviously the science is the most important thing, and really getting to the point where we understand what's going on in a disease and we have opportunities. But you also need to have the commitment of the stakeholders. So you have to have willingness in the physician community to try things, and you have to have industry willing to sort of fuel the pump with pipelines and investment. And as we discovered, it really helps to have an active nonprofit and philanthropy and excitement around doing this kind of work. And when I first got to MRA, it was really hard to get industry to want to talk about melanoma. Everybody looked at the, you know, the Pfizer experience, and you couldn't even talk to people at Pfizer. You said the word melanoma, and they cringed. You know, our first scientific conference at the MRA, I mean, I literally had to beg industry folks to want to come. And, you know, so that was frustrating. But once people start to see a little bit of success, there's a little bit of daylight, the whole world changed. And by the time I left 5 years later, it was a completely different story. Obviously, there had been drug approvals, there had been progress. And so, you know, how did that all happen? And most importantly, how do we replicate that in some of these other spaces? And I think you need to have all of the components. You must have the science. You must have enough of a energy behind understanding, you know, what drugs work. Can't just throw everything against the wall. You know, you need to have brilliant minds like Dr. Tuvison and others who are willing not to give up. In pancreatic cancer, that's, I would say, kind of where things stand now. I work with the other very large pancreatic cancer group, PanCAN. You know, again, tired of banging their heads against the wall, they're now running a study similar to I-SPY2 with an adaptive design to say, you know, let's do things differently. Rather than keep running the same thing, running these trials, spending all this money, wasting patient resources, getting into phase two and phase three, and then having these spectacular failures, let's do it differently. So I think you need all of those things to make a difference. And it really helps to have the patient advocacy community and the philanthropy to sort of shine a light and say, this is important and let's not give up. So I can say more, but that's sort of an overview.
Oh, thank you. That was a great overview, and that hopefully shines a positive light in, you know, for these intractable diseases. I mean, please, you know, speak to the sarcoma, you know, trial expert right here, Denise, in the future, so she doesn't have any issues in reaching out to the industry collaborators. You know, so similar to melanoma research alliance that Wendy experienced. So, just to kick this off, I just want to talk a little bit about, you know, how, you know, does industry, nonprofits, academics work together, and what's the best way to really push forward progress in these intractable cancers? Anybody want to take a shot at this? Hopefully everyone will eventually chime in on this, since it's all of you guys.
Well, Sark has had experience in working with small biotech, and I think that one of the great benefits of having this collaborative infrastructure is bringing the people who take care of these patients, are working in the laboratory, sitting down together with our partners in industry saying, what do they understand about the disease? What compound or agent are they bringing forward to explore within these patient populations? Designing trials together that are rationally based on our understanding of the disease and the compound, and doing more of a partnership type of approach. And I must say that I see that accrual enhancement starts right at that point, because you have people feeling buy-in and ownership because they are part of that design of the trial, as opposed to sometimes we've seen where industry will come with already a plan all set, and then it's really much more difficult, I think, for the investigators to change the path that has already been set, and maybe it's not a rational approach. And experience that we had is in this collaboration that I'm thinking of with a biotech company, we were part at the table with the design, went with them to the FDA, and we did a study in sarcoma of 640 patients that accrued in just under 3 years. And so it really showed commitment of the community, you know, to it, engagement, feeling part of it. And so it really, and during the course of that conduct of trial, with the accrual and success of the collaboration, they were able to enter into an agreement with a larger pharmaceutical company to help them further get funding for the development. So I think that was a nice example of really bringing together, you know, academic community, people understand the disease in context with folks who are developing drugs to, you know, find a new opportunity. Because I think at the end of the day, investigators want to see new drugs available to their patients, not just at the centers where the studies are being done, but broadly open and available to everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Patrick?
Yeah, regarding industry, I think I'm the one talking. Just to raise a little bit on specifically on soft tissue sarcoma, on sarcoma in general, on soft tissue sarcoma, which is the indication we're running, and to share with you the experience we have in Europe, because this indication is primary in Europe for now. We obviously work very closely with the sarcoma group of AOTC. It's also something that in the past I experienced myself when years ago we were, I really noticed that we had this chance in Europe to have a very, very strong network, able to work together was very key for us. Because when you are a biotech company and when you talk to people that are working on such sarcoma, even if they don't tell you this way, they think, why the hell are you working on sarcoma? And it's true for investors, it's true for pharma companies as well sometimes. So you have to make a significant effort because recurring sarcoma is challenging. So having access to a group of this type, well-structured and progressing together, including in the definition of endpoint, because here we are also facing some challenging specifically, pathological response, SAR zero. So there's a lot of discussion going on that. But so it was very, very beneficial to be able to work with them.
Thank you. Dr. Tuvason, your views on this?
Well, my short answer is that most of the ideas about new approaches for particular cancer usually come from those individuals who have been taking care of those patients for their whole career and working with scientists who study the biology of that disease. There are no shortage of ideas. There is a huge shortage, though, of connecting those individuals to the suppliers of therapies, and not due to a lack of interest, actually, but usually due to poor communication and lack of funds. You heard about how the Sarcoma Alliance has brought together multiple corporations, essentially, that have different medicines to work with likely dozens of investigators at a variety of academic centers who are pouring their ideas into the design of trials for different subsets of sarcoma patients. Many of these trials will include combinations of therapies where Corporation A has a therapy and Corporation B has a therapy. And in the past, these types of studies have been very challenging. CTEP has tried to make that possible, but the drugs that CTEP has to play with are not, you know, first in class. And so it's been challenging for a lot of different reasons. Everyone's looking for their home run. And there really hasn't been an earnest collaborative effort between the private and the public sector, you know, in this space. And then the patients, which is the reason why we're here in the first place, the patients, you know, are victimized by this, and they're not nearly as vocal as the AIDS patients were, you know, 20 years ago. They're getting more, but they've been very patient as we've been ineffective. Now, I don't think that there are, like, all these magic therapies that haven't been used. I just think the therapies we have been used poorly. So the melanoma example that Wendy was talking about, before the immune, right around the time that the Allison's CTLA-4 antibody was coming online, as you remember, it was the kinase inhibitors that broke through first. And the first shot on goal with the kinase inhibitors was a bust, and even the one that's now approved. But why was it a bust? It was a bust because it was 80% hitting its target. Tell me one chemotherapy trial where we have any clue how good we are with our PK in any study. The only one is Steve Salen, who studied methotrexate in kids with ALL. That's the only one. So all these adult intractable cancers, we have studied our therapies in our patients poorly, very poorly. And so part of my gestalt is that we have not applied the power of science to taking care of our patients. And we are looking for some magical solution to cancer. We need to study each patient much more deeply and actually develop biomarkers of not just should I treat the patient or not, which is what the nucleic acids are telling us, but rather am I treating the patient well or not? biomarkers of response and biomarkers of toxicity for each patient. Do real pharmacology, just like the old days. And when you combine drugs, the pharmacology becomes unpredictable. And, you know, we, you know, so this topic to me is really relevant. I actually think that we think the system is going to solve it. I disagree. I think that individuals have to become more responsible for taking care of their patients, both on the academic side, but the corporate side have to allow us to do that and to allow us to make a lot of measurements. And I think we probably could help a lot of patients with a lot of cancer in terms of eradicating the cancer, which is one of the big goals. We'll have a better shot at that if we can, you know, clear enough cells. So this has nothing to do with what type of cancer, but the intractable cancers, I think, have this as, you know, one of its major issues.
Can I just make a couple comments? So, I mean, I love what you just said, and I think that's one of the things, actually, that's a unique role for the nonprofit patient advocacy organizations and the funding that they do in research is a lot of that correlative work around the clinical trials and really understanding what's going on with the patients in the studies. And it's not always something that the companies want to pay for because the companies, you know, kind of want their shot on goal. They want to get to their overall survival endpoint. They want to get their drug approved. And it's not that the patients don't want that too, but I think really one of the places that traditionally patient advocacy groups with their philanthropic research grant dollars have been has been on really understanding what's going on and really evaluating the science and learning from the patients who are in the studies. I also want to make a comment about the change in nature of patient advocacy groups over time and the ability for a patient advocacy organization to be a sophisticated partner in drug development. You heard yesterday from Lou about how the LLS, and I'm not just talking now about investing dollars, but I'm talking about the knowledge and sort of the above the silo, above the specific agent view of what's going on in the field and the ability to bring together the experts and kind of look across different mechanisms and different potential agents and understand where the potential opportunities are. And patient advocacy groups over the years, especially in cancer, have kind of raised their game, have brought in significant in-house, you know, expert resources and chief science officers who can advise them working with their medical and scientific boards so that they can sit at the table with pharmaceutical companies and help to talk about not just the program that you have that you've decided, you know, to commit to, but what else is going on out there in the field that maybe you should consider. And they can serve as matchmaker among the companies when you want to talk about, let's say, a novel combination, and it is challenging across different companies. Having a patient advocacy group in the middle of that can sometimes sort of help diffuse some of the difficulties that you might face with your lawyers, you know, in terms of making that happen. And, of course, as you heard yesterday, obviously working with the FDA is a really important role that these groups are increasingly taking on. So again, this concept that that the different stakeholders each have a role to play, and I think the more traditional view in industry and sort of the legacy view now is that, well, we call the patient advocacy group when we need to salvage our phase 3 study because it's not accruing and we need help getting patients in. Or we call the patient advocacy group when we're going to an ODAC and we need some patient to come and talk about their experience with our drug. Or we call them after approval and we're worried about reimbursement. The whole paradigm is shifting to the opportunity much sooner to learn from the patient advocacy group and the patient experience so that the trials that we design are better, what we're learning from each patient is more robust, and we can ultimately end up with a better outcome.
If I may comment on that point, because I think this is a very interesting point, which is resonating with what we try to do, even when we're quite small, which is not always easy when you're a small company. I've been working many years with a large corporation, and many of those big companies are talking about the patient-centric thing. I don't know if they're still turning around the patient, but they have to do a lot here, but we try to do. We initiate, you know, even in our small company, we're not even 100 globally, to have a patient engagement approach. And we start to do that, obviously, initially in Europe because there's more people, but also we start to do it in the U.S., where things are much more organized mm-hmm. on that. And that's key because it's early stage, as you mentioned, and that's why I think it's very important. It's early stage, then you can really incorporate patient view in every single of your decisions. And it has to be done very early, and not just as a risk view, as you mentioned it. I think that's very, very key to be successful. It's also opening suddenly new avenues on new indication you want to start. In our case, since we have a kind of broad approach, actually applicable theoretically to every single type of solid tumor treated with radiation. So we have a broad approach. So what do we pick next? So that's also why we want to approach this way. So what are the needs and what type of problem we can solve? So this is certainly the next step. I would say not an exception. It should be some kind of rules on the way of developing even a company, I think.
And one last comment around this area. I think of the intractable cancers give us an opportunity, some of these smaller groups and populations. When you think of sarcoma crosses a number of different subtypes of tumors, and to get to Dr. Tuberson's point about the science and understanding, I can think of a study that we had done 12 years ago looking at the IGF-1R antibody, and it turned out that there were 11% of Ewing sarcoma patients that responded to it. And unfortunately, we were working with Dr. Dinger at the time, and the portfolio had moved over to Celgene Roche moved the portfolio. Genentech, thank you. And so they decided their portfolio was too big. They couldn't develop all of these drugs, and so this trial was stopped. And the disappointment was that we didn't have sufficient biospecimens to evaluate what was it about that group of patients. Because if you look at Herceptin, the response was 11% initially until they had a biomarker. And so really, I think this partnering of science and industry is going to be so important to try to understand not only what works, but what didn't work. Our hypothesis, I think it was Dr. Ibrahim yesterday talked about that, about how important it is when we're done. We had a hypothesis going into this work, you know, then at the end of it, if it didn't work out, it's as important to understand why not, why didn't it, so that we can learn for the next steps and the next designs going forward.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I agree with, you know, these points that there needs to be some sort of newer, innovative designs. And I think yesterday we had a panel that was supposed to talk a little bit more into that. Maybe we can talk a little bit now about it, you know, Dr. Tuberson's point about, you know, needing to really understand the science and get the scientists involved and everyone involved in this process. What's being done right now to really, you know, target? I mean, we also mentioned about the MSI-high patients are being, you know, they're being addressed right now, but it's such a small patient population. But what else is being done for the majority of the patients that are not being addressed by these, you know, very targeted therapies for a specific small patient population?
So again, my view of it from the pancreas cancer-centric perspective is that the common medicines, the approved cytotoxic drugs, actually have tremendous activity in small subsets of pancreas cancer patients. But it's been hard to see those subsets before because nobody has ever properly studied this. And so one thing that we are starting to do is to design approaches to identify such individuals. And my feeling is that actually amongst the four approved chemotherapies for pancreas cancer, they cover the majority of patients in terms of extreme responders to even chemotherapy. But by the way, we've designed things in the past, we had no shot of even seeing this. So again, the targeted therapy concept, the red carpet, the Lazarus effect. I know a lot about it because when I was a young fella, I studied something called leiomyosarcoma of the stomach. And I don't know how long Denise has been in her role, but that's what it was called.
Long enough, yeah.
That's what it was called. And I decided I should learn how to write clinical trials when I was an oncology fellow. And so I wrote a trial to study this this patient population, and I was going to use a so-called RAS inhibitor, which at the time was a farnesyl transferase inhibitor. So I learned how to wrote the trial. Paper came out in Science from a small group in Japan saying that there's this mutation in these tumors, and we think we should call it something else. So they decided they'd change the name to GI stromal tumors. So I was in Boston, and the same shop where Brian Drucker left because he couldn't do his trial there. But I was able to get the compound, put it on cells at a basic science lab across the river, and it killed the cells, and the chemotherapy didn't. And so I actually saw the whole targeted therapy thing go from, you know, concept to big hit in this smallish population of patients, a couple thousand a year. But it was dramatic and amazing. I think we've gotten addicted to that concept that there's this Achilles heel, and unless you find Achilles, you have no shot of taking Troy. And I think it's incorrect. I actually do think that we have so many medicines that are generic now or still protected that work really, really well, and we just have not studied them properly. And so my take to the intractable cancers is, why don't we study what's right in front of us and do it properly? Because going back to Wendy's first love, melanoma, I mean, we never would even have the kinase inhibitors unless we actually, like, buckled our, you know, tightened our belts and got proper in terms of how we deliver the BRAF kinase inhibitor. Now, that turns out not to be as good an idea as using a polytherapy immune approach. Those are the curative approaches that we have on the table today. But, we just forgot that. You know, I mean, so, and that we have to, I think, return to that concept for all our common cytotoxic drugs, learn how to give them better, how to give them in the right way so we get a bigger hit on the cancer cell, less toxicity to the rest of the body. I actually think that we could help patients a lot just with that seemingly mundane, approach. And we have a study that will elaborate on these points that you can read in a few weeks probably. Anyway, that was a long answer to your question. So I don't actually think there's this magic new thing that we need to look for. I think we need to study harder what we have in front of us, and we can help a lot of patients.
Thanks for this comment. And to this point, maybe also to be back a bit to radiation, because it's certainly something of interest. FDA recently, and you know the paper now, last year published something quite interesting. Actually, it says the people. It's actually Amanda Walker publishing this paper. You know it, Jeff. And what's very exciting for me to read was first that something like 10 years, 250 drugs in oncology have been approved. And only one has been approved, cetuximab, in combination with radiation. So FDA is pushing now to make the regulatory path also to use something which is existing for decades and to be used properly. Of course, the science is helping, and we know that radiation plus immuno-oncology has been shown some promises, and it's part of it, but PARP inhibitor as well. There's a lot to do here. So that's to say that among the modalities, there's certainly a way also for those, particularly for those, type of cancer to rethink the way we've been developing, the way that people are doing to make it happen for the patient. And basically, when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about the way that we've been starting the company in clinics 7 years ago, more or less. It's been always based on a compromise, as usual, because you have to run the company, on medical needs or non-satisfactory situation of a standard of care and radiation in that case, where we started sarcoma was a kind of bet because here you are facing huge tumors who are resistant, but you can show an improvement here. But then we move along in head and neck. And what did we pick in head and neck? We didn't pick, the easy path. We picked the elderly who are not addressed most of the time, who are badly addressed, who don't have that much option, sometimes non-eligible to chemo, or even if chemo is there, very weak improvement, and to make it happen again. And with the, you know, putting on the top, obviously an innovation which is transforming potentially the input of the radiation in that case. So it's, yes, it's all about thinking again on what you can do with an existing sometime, and thinking about innovation maybe not only by better define a single pathway, but taking a step back and look broadly on what's going on.
Great, thank you. Wendy?
So, I mean, I know that in the importance of the business decisions in terms of determining a program to take forward and, you know, go and no-go and all those kinds of things. But I would say, you know, probably the only people that are more disappointed when something doesn't work out than the shareholders or the company executives are the patients and the patient community, and not just the patients who were in the studies and their physicians, but the broad patient community, especially with these intractable cancers. The chief science officer for PanCAN, Lynn Matrizian, wrote a paper that was published in the last 2 years doing a retrospective look at the phase 3 studies in pancreatic cancer that failed, and going back looking at the phase 2 studies that preceded them and trying to evaluate whether those should have even gone to phase 3. And some of those decision-making paradigms that occur, you know, when you have an intractable cancer and you have such a problem and you have so much unmet need and there's so much hope, you know, sometimes people will grasp at maybe not the best straws to say, well, let's push it forward. And it is true that the patient community is out there cheering, saying, you know, going into phase 3, that sounds good and let's go. But really the need, you know, back to the basics, to really understand the science and make better decisions about not just what you take forward, but what you don't take forward, so that you can concentrate your financial and your patient resources on the things that are the most likely to succeed. So to answer your question about these novel trial designs, and we heard about master protocols and basket studies and adaptive trials. So PanCAN is trying an adaptive study approach called Precision Promise for pancreatic cancer, designed to do some of the work that Dr. Tuveson described, to really understand the patients and the sequencing and all the things about the patients coming into the study, and then at every step of the study, not only because they hope to bring new drugs to patients, but also because they really hope to learn and inform the field along the way. And this is happening also in glioblastoma with GBM Agile. Again, trying to sort of disrupt the paradigm, the typical, you know, preclinical phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 paradigm, to be able to learn more from these precious resources of patients that we have.
I just wanted to make one quick comment. I was around in sarcoma at the time of gastrointestinal stromal tumor, and I, you know, as a clinician, I'm a nurse practitioner in sarcoma as well, and, you know, we had no treatments for those patients, and honestly, it was literally that kind of a Lazarus of 1 week they came in, you know, on a stretcher, and then they got Gleevec, and they're, you know, it was incredible. But I think that one of so that was intractable. That was something somebody would not have thought that they should put money into or to develop, because the population isn't that big. However, I know that the Southwest Oncology Group just did a look back of patients who were treated on that very first trial, and they found that 23% of patients are still being treated 10 years later. So they're still getting the drug. So from a standpoint of business as well, you know, so why study intractable diseases? You don't really necessarily know where some of those hits are going to be, or where that kind of runway length of time of treatment is going to be of benefit. And I don't think anyone would have predicted when you were first doing your experiments on leiomyosarcoma cells of the stomach that would be the case down the road, because it was such a tough disease.
Yeah. So. Question in the audience?
Yeah, hi. This is a wonderful discussion that you're having right now, and I have a few questions that I want to feed in about this. So, Dr. Tuveson, you'd mentioned the whole issue of going through what currently exists. It strikes me that real-world evidence might be a tremendous resource, going through what patients have already experienced looking through claims data, looking through electronic health records, to generate hypotheses that you can then explore in trials. And then as a corollary to that, the potential for registries within patient foundations to be such a tremendous resource. And so my question is, to what extent are these being looked at? And for the foundations, to what extent are you actively developing that and talking to each other so that you can come up with some kind of standardized approach so that potentially you can pull information across foundational registries?
I think maybe Wendy should speak to this first, because as she's talked about, PanCAN has a large clinical trials concept that they're launching, where getting a registry, as you described, will be relevant. So her comments on this will be pertinent. I would say for pancreas cancer in particular, the problem is that patients don't live long enough. Mm-hmm. And so when the comments about why do trials fail in randomized setting, well, when you have a academic-driven phase one or phase two trial, the quality of the supportive care is ridiculously good. And when you do with randomized studies, you usually have to include non-academic sites. And your supportive care almost always is not the same standard as you would get at academic sites. So that's, of course, an optimistic view of why things fail in phase three. The pessimistic view is that it's biases by the academic investigators enrolling healthy patients at, you know, Joe Ivory Tower, whereas, you know, in the community that doesn't happen. I don't have that view of it. I do think that at least in pancreas cancer, where the lifespan of the patient is actually very short, how well you take care of the patient really matters. I don't know that we have deep information in this disease that would answer your question, but there are other cancers where that information does exist and where people are doing exactly what you say. Breast cancer, colon cancer, you know, diseases where the runway is long, where you have, you know, much more information available. People are exactly doing what you're saying. And, you know, my point about let's learn more about the drugs we currently have was meant not to mean that I don't think we should look for the targeted therapies that are going to have the big hit in pancreas cancer or glioblastoma, because we need them. But those therapies will only work if we first debulk the patient and we actually cripple the disease to the point where the patient is well so we can treat them. There, you know, most studies suggest that if you have sick patients and you put them on trials, you don't learn anything, because the patients only qualify for the trial for a few days or a few weeks, and you basically have a null experiment. And, you know, that's part of the complication with this disease, is you need to actually improve the health of the patient so that you can actually give them a shot of novel therapies. And I actually think we can improve the health of the patient if we could study more scientifically the therapies that we currently have approved. And that's kind of the point I'm trying to make. And so our foundation has invested far more in the science side of things. We didn't start out as an advocacy organization for pancreas cancer. We really tried to understand why. Why was this so bad? Why was the government investing very little in this disease? Why were there so few scientists in the disease? I've had the benefit of being affiliated with both organizations. In my beginning of my career, I had a grant from PanCAN, which I'm always grateful for. But we've spent much more effort on trying to understand the science of pancreas cancer, and we've had some success in that. And so the trials that we're going to start are ones where we're going to try to debulk patients and then talk to everybody in this room about their novel therapies, because we'll have patients that are well enough to get them so that we can actually get to the bottom of this. But we're you know, keenly interested in working together with PanCAN and the government and anybody who can have an impact on this disease. Our interest is to put ourselves out of work, and so far we have failed at that. So, anyway, why don't you, if Wendy wanted to say something about
that. I just want to comment on registries. It's actually interesting. It's something that the Janet Woodcock of the FDA talks about when she, and not just in cancer, but just as a really important role for patient foundations, which is to create these natural history registries, right? So so that there's something to evaluate against in terms of if we did nothing, where would this disease go and what's the patient experience? And so PanCAN has a patient registry. And again, I just want to comment. I'm a consultant. I work with PanCAN, so I'm not an official PanCAN spokesman, but I do know about their programs. And so they do talk to a lot of patients, and they do have a very significant registry, and they do follow patients for the life of their, unfortunately, sometimes very short life of the journey because it's so dramatically devastating and happens so quickly. They also have a program now, which is feeding into this Precision Promise trial program, which is called Know Your Tumor, where they're actually providing the opportunity for patients to have their tumor sequenced and to have a report generated for the patient and the physician using Foundation One, but something that's a little more digestible, looking for those rare mutations and then, you know, where do you go from here? So they're trying, they're kind of many shots on goal, multiple programs trying to create the whole story because it's clear that it's not going to be one single silver bullet. And I do want to make a comment about taking care of the patients and having them live long enough so they can get some of these new therapies. And actually in melanoma, you rightly point out the BRAF experience. You know, one of the things about that is that there were these patients who were so sick. And some of them, when they were treated with those early BRAF inhibitors, had a very miraculous turnabout, which allowed them perhaps to live long enough to get an immunotherapy that needed a number of months before it could start to work on their immune system. And so, again, you know, putting these things in sequence or in combination is so important, you know, for that opportunity for the patients to live longer. And I do think that the supportive care and the type of care that patients are getting along the way is not just important for pancreatic cancer, it's important for all cancers, you know, brain tumor patients as well. So,
I just want to make one cautionary note about registries and different groups between them. Within the sarcoma community, there are over 20 different patient advocacy groups, and many of them have initiated registries. And the challenge many of them are finding is that it's only as good as your ability to verify the data, how you're putting the data in, and they have spent so much of their resource doing it, hoping that it will shed some light, and only to find out that the quality isn't there. And so you have all these people working so very hard with their limited resources, and it ends up not being as helpful as what we'd like it to be. So while it sounds like a great idea broadly, the devil's in the details, so really a cautionary note on it.
So that's an amazing point. I just want to say to that point, there are some collectivizing organizations that are trying to create standards and help to educate people on how to do this. So Faster Cures, if you're familiar with them, has done a lot of work in this area. And in rare disease, with funding from the FDA, so NORD, has been giving grants to some rare disease organizations to help them set up proper registries. A really great point.
So, question?
Yeah, hi. I'm Andrew Bush. I wanted to pick up on something Ms. Selig said, which I thought was really fascinating and observant and important and relevant to the whole industry, which is that phase two trials that look very encouraging then go to phase three and fail. That happens all the time. And we've heard a lot about patient organizations and what they do. And I think I don't want to be insensitive here, but it's indisputable they do good things. They raise money, they do registries. These people are dying, right? But that's a problem because then the unmet need is so large. And I'd argue, and I'm curious what the panel thinks here, is the unmet need is so large. People are dying. Industry may make money if the phase three is successful. I'm asking, is there a less than positive benefit from the patient organization saying, we're dying, we need something now. Don't think long term. Don't think about what causes pancreatic cancer. We know about RAS, but I'm astonished to hear you say you want to work on more cytotoxics. And believe me, I'd like to make this comment humble. If I had pancreatic cancer, I'd be coming right to you and ask you to treat me because you need great people. But the point of my question is this. The heretical aspect of it is I think patient organizations and patients actually have a slightly downside. And the downside is that less dispassionate we all know how hard it is to develop something for an accessible drug in cancer, and that maybe we need to have them, as best as we can, say, think long term, think that life is short but art is long, and find out what causes pancreatic cancer or these different things. And that's just my opinion. I want to hear what you think.
Yeah, so actually within the last year, I've been trying to herd the cats of the patient advocacy groups within sarcoma, and there is such a thread of passion. Each one has gotten into it because of their own either personal story of themselves, their loved one, and it is really very personal. And but I must say that many people seem to be able to step back and say, maybe this happened to me, but I don't want it to happen to someone else. And I do see that we've been able to kind of channel some of their thought process to what's the greater good, what's the long term. We might not be able to make a difference today, but they do recognize that they want to make a difference for future as well. And I think we still need to find that right place for the voice, whether it's helping to work with research advocacy programs. I know that the NCI has been working very hard to educate advocates so that they know how to sit at a table for clinical trial design with, you know, esteemed researchers like Dr. Tuvison and not feel intimidated, be able to have a voice at those tables. So it is an important
But I suppose
point.
My question is the voice of that table dispassionate, right? I mean, they're dying, and they're saying, we need something. That's what's going on in the primitive parts of their brain, right? Understandably, right? But does that help Dr. Tuvison make the right call for the phase three trial?
So I think that there's a distinction between the patient sometimes and the patient advocacy organization, right? So the collective voice. An individual patient's motivation sitting in a room talking about this, you know, could run the gamut. You know, that person could be only thinking about themselves, which is totally understandable, or they could be thinking, I never want anyone else to go through this, and what can be learned from me, and you have the array of that. And I think a patient advocacy organization, especially the ones that are more sophisticated now, have the ability to carry the passion of the individual voices, but to see dispassionately the future of the field. But you're right, and I think part of what's fueling now this right to try movement is this, you know, desperation. If there's something out there that may possibly somehow work, why can't I have it? My personal view is that sort of preys on people's hope. It's not going to create anything better for those patients, and what it could do is dismantle the clinical trial drug development system that will help many patients. I think that the more sophisticated patient advocacy organizations think about, yes, we want companies to invest in our disease and run trials. That doesn't necessarily mean we want you to take a bad concept forward and waste money and waste patients in failure. What it means is if you have something you were hopeful and it didn't work, don't run away from our disease. Come back and learn from it and do something else. The most frustrating thing for me as an advocate is when a company gets all excited about a space because they have an indication coming, and they invest in patient advocacy and they fund the groups and they show up at the walks and they put their logo out there and they say, hey, we are a fill-in-the-blank kind of company. And then their drug fails and you never hear from them again. So that is what we have to change. Companies need to commit to a disease, not an agent. And if you're really committed to a disease, even if your particular agent fails, number one, you'll go back and you'll look. Maybe we had some exceptional responders. What can we learn about that? How can we do it differently? And number two, let's look in our pipeline and see what else we have in this disease and keep going. I think that is a changing paradigm that people need to understand. And it will allow companies not to be afraid to get involved in a disease earlier. I used to hear in melanoma, we don't want to talk to you, Wendy, at the MRA because we're still very early in melanoma, and we don't know if we're going to stay in melanoma. And I would say to them, that is the wrong approach. Come into melanoma and figure out how you can make what you're doing work there, rather than match up what you happen to have that you think might go, and then come back and be our best friends.
Very nice.
So I think the main problem is still actually that very few patients enroll on clinical trials. We're talking like as if everyone goes on a trial.
Right.
It's single digits. They go on clinical trials in the United States of America. Okay, same as socialized medicine countries. So our problem is that despite our best intentions and lofty goals, we enroll very few patients on clinical trials. And why is that? I think that should only be the case if we have curative approaches to whatever the disease is. And for this topic, it's by definition not curable. So, you know, a huge advance would be if patients with, quote, intractable cancer had a shot to enroll on a trial that empowers them, that makes them feel like they're doing something to fight. Might help them, certainly will help knowledge. And, you know, the trials that we've set up in the past, they're not, you know, particularly intellectual the way they're set up. We have to go into these trials eyes wide open. We have to have biomarkers of continuous response that we're following while we treat the patients. Not the biopsy 2 years ago, but rather their drop of blood today when you see them in the clinic. And I don't know on your schedule if you spend any time on, you know, cell-free DNA or any of the new reaching methods that are going to be truly personalized medicine. Because that's where every patient is going to have their own biomarkers of their disease. And we need to, again, be very dynamic with how we take care of our patients, and we're not. And I think if we just did that, we would find all kinds of our trials were positive because we actually were paying attention to individual patients on the trials. We think that they're this patient with this disease as a static entity, and that's obviously incorrect. They have a disease that constantly evolves. Turns out we actually have second-line therapies that we never give those patients because we don't realize they're evolving right in front of us. And I think the trial design should be altered so that every patient, you're constantly monitoring them, constant monitoring, allowing us to be more agile with each patient. And until we get to that stage, I think that's going to be our maturation moment. Then patients will have a chance of multiple therapies because you can do microdosing and things that we never talk about. Do measurements, often measurements, to see if we're on the right track with patients. The immunotherapies tend to take longer, but that's actually, I would say that's from a radiographic standpoint true, but not from a standpoint of looking at tiny analytes. You can tell pretty quickly, usually, if your immune therapy thing is in the right direction. So we have to be more sophisticated how we follow each patient. That's what I come back to. And then the new medicines will have a real chance.
Thank you. Another question.
So I'm from Leukemia Lymphoma Society. I work in the blood cancer space, and I just wanted to give you a couple of comments about small indications. For one, you know, I think Mike mentioned, you know, every blood cancer is an orphan disease. There are under 200,000 patients, and there are 175 of these diseases, right? So we have actually invested intentionally in really rare diseases, such as hairy cell leukemia, Waldenstrom's, Erdheim-Chester disease, Langhans cell histiocytosis, some weird stuff you probably don't even know about. So why did we do it? Because the mechanisms, the underpinning of the biology was like a zinger. In Waldenstrom's, 95% of the patients have mid-D88 mutations, and ibrutinib works really well there. It took 68 patients of Steve Treon to basically get that drug approved for Waldenstrom's. Hairy cell leukemia, same thing, 95% of the patients, BRAF mutations. And even Erdheim-Chester, where there's 50% of BRAF mutations, the other percentages have basically RASopathies. And it's the same thing in Langerhans with that childhood disease. So we've actually gone in that direction. And I've been in situations where, for hairy cell leukemia, we didn't even have enough money to fund it. And I went to other foundations, and we just decided we're just doing it and put extra money into it because we saw the opportunity there. So I just wanted to say that, you know, for rare diseases, we've actually, this has been a very interesting and good area for the blood cancers. I wouldn't say necessarily profitable because that sort of enters into the pharma range, but and that's actually a bit of a problem because these diseases are so small that to actually make money at them, you wouldn't choose that first. But in terms of proof of concept, they're a zinger. You can get a readout from blood, and you can get it quickly, and those patients tend to live long-term. For the Waldenstrom's patients, so you can get long-term readouts. AML mesothelin, 500 patients a year, maybe 200 patients have mesothelin. These kids who have overexpression, we're going to take the Bayer drug for mesothelin that didn't work out so well in solid tumors and bring it into pediatrics. We've sort of motivated. We've actually partnered with Bayer to do this, to incentivize them. And so we do a lot of incentivizing. In fact, 35% of our portfolio has pharma drugs in our academic grants have pharma drugs in them. And one final comment. Imagine what would happen if imatinib turned out to be useful in GIST today. Could you develop it? The problem with, as these drugs sort of head to their end of lifespan and generics, it's a really serious problem to get pharma motivated where it could require tens or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to demonstrate activity in a drug that's basically at the end of its at the end of its lifespan. That's a real challenge.
Thank you. That's a perfect segue to maybe this last section of what I want to talk about is really about the business perspective here, because really we've been talking about the clinical trials and how, you know, we can benefit the patients in the future. But really the question comes down to we need help from industry, right? It's not going to just be the nonprofits and the David Tuvisons of the world. We need funding, and that's where the biotech and pharma industry comes in. So how do you really, you know, de-risk, you know, these risky cancers, and how do you, you know, generate the story for your, you know, shareholders? There's a return on investment. So I'm going to go straight to Patrick on this one.
Yeah, this is a challenge, that's for sure. Yeah. I think for us it's been also a chance linked to our modality. Because compared to what you normally see, which is a biotech company having, you know, one or two or three different products on one or two different targets or pathway, we have a product which is broad enough to be potentially applicable largely, so that allowed us at the beginning to start with a proof concept when you want to start a first-in-class product. When you want to inject intratumoral nanoparticles, you need to put yourself in the worst-case scenario if you want to de-risk your entire product and portfolio potentially. So that's why sarcoma was started. Because when you're able to show that you're safe and it's feasible to inject within a tumor, and yesterday, by the way, I was so happy to hear that the people have good results by injecting also a PD-1 in, you know, in lesion. That's very interesting and very encouraging for us, by the way. But more seriously here, I think it was one of the main reasons. But you can do it because later on you can start head and neck. You can start liver, still if you are non-operable liver, HCC or liver met, and rectum, and prostate high risk still can be considered. But, you know, you have a product here which has a potential to make it happen, if I may say, broadly, and that's why you can still consider that the proof of concept of sarcoma, which is a proof of concept, put yourself in a situation. But that's linked with a business model that you can do because of a modality that you can do. Most of the time, people are struggling with this, and it's not that easy to move on. Then you're facing basically the same thing later on, because when now you're discussing with pharma companies how you could move forward on other indication, they're more interested if you're coming with something which is broader and larger in terms of indication. So you are a little bit in the middle of a gate and trying to push. And how do you do that? You're lucky enough to have a product which has also an immune onco component, and where you have your core business in standalone development on those education I mentioned, and in addition combination that you start, because here you can leverage an interest which is broader and understandable by some other stakeholders that you have to deal with. So that's actually the way we've been able to develop the company and develop largely, but it's certainly not, I would say, a classical path for biotech companies.
Right. Hi, I'm Ben Cowan, CEO of Immunomet, and I wanted to follow up on the biotech side of this. I wonder how many potential drugs in these intractable cancers don't get to phase two. You've talked about going from phase two to phase three. So we have a OXPHOS inhibitor that targets resistant tumors in phase one, and we have very compelling preclinical data in a number of solid tumors, including GBM, lung, gastric, and lymphoma. So as we consider a clinical development program for phase two, we've been very highly advised, as we're going to go out for VC funding, to basically hide our GBM data under the rug and not show it. And it's perhaps our most compelling data. It's actually published, done by an SAB member who is an expert in this area. He's looked at all different drugs around the world, and he says our drug has the highest efficacy he's ever seen. So here we are in a situation where we may not take a shot on goal.
Why were you advised to hide it?
So VCs are very skeptical of funding in intractable cancers such as GBM and pancreatic. So we are looking at, we have, as you mentioned, shots on goal, typically 2 to 3 shots on goal as a biotech company at our stage for proof of concept, and we'll probably choose lung, gastric, or other area. Now, we're considering doing an investigator-sponsored study in GBM, a very low-risk, a lower investment, but we have a real commitment to GBM and patients in that area, unmet need. But I think many biotech companies with our data would just put GBM under the rug. So I wonder, again, how many drugs going into phase two you never see?
So I would say this is why the advocacy groups actually exist, is your story. And I don't work with the GBM advocacy group, but I suspect they would be all ears to hear the data from your talented scientist who's on your SAB who had those words. And I actually do think that you have an outlet down in Bethesda, too, if that's actually the data that you have.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't throw in the towel on GBM. Now, you know, your problem you're going to have is actually you don't have enough time to do everything that you want to do, not just that you don't have enough money. But I would say don't, you know, that's like the wrong the wrong way to live and to approach your objectives. That's just incorrect. I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, so I work with the National Brain Tumor Society, so we should talk afterwards, and if you're not connected to them, I'm happy to connect you to them. I work with a lot of groups. They have similar problems. But, you know, so I would turn the question around to you and say, what is it that you need? You know, what is it that, so, okay, it's the money guys who are telling you that that's, they're risk averse, but how can we change that paradigm? You know, what do we need to do so that that is no longer the case? Because I mean, that's just painful to hear. And from a patient perspective, if TJ were here, I mean, he'd be jumping up and down. Like, you know, really, this is the wrong incentive model. This is the wrong dynamic. So what can we collectively do to change that? And I don't know whether it's, you know, getting some of the NCI grants that are out there for small companies working in certain spaces. I don't know what it is, but I think we need to figure that out because that hurts to hear.
Can I just make a comment? You know, there's now increasingly, you know, like we talked about yesterday, these adaptive platform trials. So GBM Agile is an adaptive platform trial, and the whole, when we started I-SPY, the entire reason for doing this was to try and figure out how to take a risk at a point in time where you might make a difference in the course of in the trajectory of the disease for relatively small investment, you know, so you get a promising phase two agent and you try it, and if it doesn't work, you rapidly adapt it out. And finding that the more success you have, actually, the harder it is to take riskier strategies forward because people are afraid not to do the standard thing. But the mentality in GBM is, you know, we operate on people and do this because the results are so good, really. You know, same thing for pancreatic cancer. We should do the standard of care and all these things because our results are so good. They're terrible. You know, and so really, I think there needs to be, you know, that, you know, you ought to go to the GBM Agile people. I'm happy, you know, to introduce you. And, you know, they're trying to start this international trial. You get to, that's the place to do it if you've got good data. You know, it's a phase 2-3. I mean, and the bar for safety is pretty low in a disease that is uniformly fatal. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that if we want to see change, we can't keep doing the same thing. So there are groups of investigators who are aligning to try and do things differently. And, you know, maybe that's, and there are people out there who are interested in funding some of these new models. Andrew Lowe from MIT has really led a huge effort to try and change the way things are funded. So just don't go there. I mean, look, you can't go the traditional route for funding if you want to do something novel. You're a startup. You want to take risk, take real risk. And don't go to the venture people who are not interested in risk. You know, that's the marriage that we need. We need the funders who are interested. Venture is supposed to be about taking risk, not doing safe things and getting your money back. Well, maybe it's not really, but that's what it should be about. So we need a new generation of funding. We need a new generation of investigators. But the new generation of investigators, there's Pancreatic Promise. There is, you know, in I-SPY, we've actually led the way. And there's several other trials coming behind us. And even if the NCI doesn't make it that there by where, there are plenty of these big trials trying to try, you know, promising new things. Small, fail fast, small investments, to allow people to figure out what the signal is and move forward. So just don't go the traditional path. If you've got something good, make it happen.
And I think that's why I like research consortiums like SARC, where you're bringing investigators together to bring these new compounds, try it out, less of an investment, and get some understanding of the science, you know, biospecimens, understand, and hopefully then either it's something that's going to be a winner or not, but at least you explore it.
Thank you. One last question.
I'm sorry this came up at the end because I think it is a very important point. So I'm Bob Spiegel. I was the chief medical officer at Schering Plough when we developed temozolomide, which was, at the time, the first drug that had gotten approved since procarbazine. And unfortunately, 20 years later, it's still the only drug approved for first-line treatment in GBM. Schering at that time, for registration, did a 250-patient study that was able to show 2.5 months improved PFS. We didn't even have OS data at the time of initial approval. So that was the paradigm. Fortunately, we had great interest in the U.S. and the European community. There was active enrollment that didn't take that long. We had to follow the patients a long time. So I've since been asked many times by small companies who think they have a lead in GBM, what do you think? And I think your experience is exactly what VCs would say. If you can raise $25 or $50 million in your Series A, are you going to put it into a very high-risk area? And I think for all the reasons David said, a lot of these small phase 2 studies that are promising to usually small companies have gone down a path and failed. So they often take a small group of patients. They show early PFS results that they compare to historical results and say, look, our patients are living, advanced patients are living 12 months, and historically you would have only expected 9 months. We're going to go in and do a big phase 3 trial. And there are numerous vaccines and small molecules that have failed. I think many of them, there was a selection bias in the patients that were put in, or for reasons David said, they don't, it's a difficult disease. We don't have biomarkers that are easy. Did we get good levels in the brain? All those things become questions after the larger trial failed. So I think the kinds of things Laura said, for we could spend time on GBN as an example, but I think all the things that were discussed yesterday and today about trying to find different models where you can get early signals, whether you can find a biomarker, whether there are other ways to assess that the activity is real or identify a subpopulation that you might be able to show the effect in instead of muting your results with such a large one, is the challenge in all of these intractable diseases. So I just think I'm glad you brought up your case. It's not unusual, and I think GBM is a good example. It's one of these diseases that's considered a graveyard, and people are scared away from it, although there's no question it's an unmet medical need.
Thank you, Bob. If there aren't any more questions, I think I want to, you know, acknowledge our panelists for such a great panel, and thank you very much for attending.